My name is Russell Hsiao. I am the Executive Director at the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is a 501c3 nonprofit think tank dedicated exclusively to Taiwan policy research. In pursuit of that end, we undertake several major initiatives, which include a weekly e-journal that we publish called the Global Taiwan Brief. If you aren't already subscribed, you may do so on our website at www.globaltaiwan.org. Our second major initiative that you are participating in right now is our seminar series. And today's special seminar is particularly special, and I'll get to that later.
Special.
Always correcting me, Steve. Thank you. And third, we are in the process of planning an annual symposium, our flagship conference, where we will assess U.S. policy options towards Taiwan. And the idea is to bring together the supporters of a stronger U.S.-Taiwan relationship. We may not necessarily agree on how to get there, but to be able to establish a baseline and the metrics on how to assess the progress and perhaps pitfalls of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. Another program that we have that is in the works right now is a scholarship program to encourage American students, postgraduates, and young scholars to conduct field research in Taiwan. And so announcements about that will be coming shortly. So today, before I begin, I want to acknowledge some of the distinguished guests that we have in the room today, to include our chairman of the board, Dr. Robert Lai. Thank you for being here. Our vice chair, Jennifer Hu. Jennifer, are you here? She's in the back over there. Also some of our co-founders, as well as advisors, such as Dr. Chen Wenyan. Thank you. Dr. David Tsai. And clearly of our international advisory board members, one of which includes Ambassador Stephen Young, John Tastic, I see John here also as well, Gordon Chang, who is another one of our panelists, and many others who are really just at the front lines of the scholarship about U.S.-Taiwan relationship. And last but not least, really, I want to acknowledge the excellent contribution made by our staff at GTI that really makes all the events and programs that we've put together possible. And they are David An, Melissa Newcomb, Annabelle, and Lily Lin. And so to begin, Donald J. Trump is now the 45th president of the United States. As president-elect, President Trump broke with decades of conventions by accepting a congratulatory phone call from the democratically elected president of Taiwan. As on the campaign trail and with the phone calls with Tsai Ing-wen, and most recently with Xi Jinping, as well as his comments questioning and then affirming the U.S. one-China policy, Trump has consistently signaled that his presidency will be, at the very least, an unconventional one. Now, to be sure, the president has shown that he will not, in his perspective, be beholden to the norms towed unquestionably by previous administrations, and outline a vision for American policy that places America first and exerts peace through strength. These broad principles ostensibly also applies to Asia. The pivot or strategic balance to Asia, which has been the hallmark of the former Obama administration's foreign policy, highlighted a bright spot in an otherwise bleak and conflict-prone world. But it hung on a delicate balance, a balance that I would argue is in search of a new equilibrium. No matter how you cut the issue, whether Asia is on an inevitable rise or perhaps a fractured region threatened by stagnation and instability, Taiwan is and must remain a key element of that future, perhaps now more than ever. As a global economic power, fifth largest in Asia, 15th in terms of global competitiveness according to the World Economic Forum, and also the 10th largest trading partner of the United States, ahead of Italy, Switzerland, Netherlands, Australia, to name only a few. But perhaps most importantly, Taiwan is a key democratic and security partner of the United States in the Asia Pacific. So what will President Trump's policy towards Taiwan be? What should it be? What can we learn from the past? And what is the future direction of Taiwan policy under the Trump administration? These are some of the key questions that we will address in today's seminar. To tackle these fundamental questions, To unpack all these recent events, we have really convened an incredible panel of experts with experience in government, diplomacy, policymaking, as well as seasoned observers of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship in order to tackle pressing questions about U.S.-Taiwan relations. We'll begin today's panel with opening remarks by the former director of the American Institute in Taiwan, Ambassador Stephen Young. Then we'll be followed by a panel discussion with distinguished experts whom I will introduce later. The Q&A from the audience will follow the panel discussion. Now, Ambassador Young served as a U.S. diplomat for over 33 years, with assignments in Washington, Taipei, Moscow, Beijing, Kyrgyzstan, and Hong Kong. He earned a BA in Wesleyan University and a PhD in history at the University of Chicago. Young was ambassador to the Kyrgyz Republic, director of the American Institute in Taiwan, and consul general to Hong Kong. Young first lived in Taiwan as a teen in the 1960s when his father was a military assistance advisory group advisor to the Taiwan military. I'm sure you'll share some of his stories there. He has lived a total of 11 years in Taiwan. Now that he's retired since 2013, he has been writing and speaking a lot about U.S.-Taiwan relations, U.S.-Asia relations. He was a visiting professor at Wesleyan University last year, where he taught a seminar on modern Chinese foreign policy. Young speaks Russian and Chinese. His wife, Barbara Fenimore, founded the China program in Beijing for the Natural Resource Defense Council. Please join me in welcoming our opening remark speaker, Ambassador Stephen Young.
Thank you very much, Russell, and thank you, everyone, for coming here to hear me and my ghost colleagues who are still probably having lunch outside. I want to thank the Global Taiwan Institute for hosting this important event, particularly Russell and also Dr. Lin, the chairman, and Jennifer Hu. And I also want to recognize a couple of people in the audience. My sister Joanne is here. She also lived in Taiwan with me and probably has her own stories, but this is my turn to tell them. And I also see my very able colleague, Bob Wong, in the back of the room. Bob was my deputy in Taiwan and has had a very distinguished career in Asia himself, so one of these days you should get him to speak. But there you go. Well, nice to see you, Bob. So I want to put a little perspective into my discussion of where we are today in terms of both U.S.-Taiwan relations and also cross-strait relations. As Russell indicated, many years ago, I lived in southern Taiwan, in Kaohsiung, in the early 60s. And I remember one day we heard that there was some excitement in the naval port of Tsoying, which was nearby. So we biked over there, and there had been stories of a clash in the Taiwan Strait between the Taiwan Navy and the People's Republic of China Navy, and there was a frigate in the dock that had been in this battle and had big holes. I mean, this big holes in the hull. Of course, the Taiwan media said it had been a smashing victory for the Taiwan side. And I wondered what the other side's ships looked like. And I remember also at the time Zhang Jingguo, who was not a top official, I think he was a minister of defense then, was giving out awards on the platform of the ship. But it brought home to me as a boy that the cross-strait relationship was not something abstract, but it was quite serious. So in some respects, we can all be thankful that Taiwan and China are talking to each other a little bit and not shooting at each other as they used to. So there's been a long history of new administrations having some time taken to adjust to their policy toward Taiwan. And I think that although we're seeing some of this with President Trump and his administration, it's not the first time. I remember as a young officer, candidate Ronald Reagan suggesting that the shift of relations to China was something wrongheaded that he wanted to address. He showed a great nostalgia for Taiwan. He had visited there as governor of California and so forth. And yet, after becoming the president, he realized that you really could not ignore China. And I was working on the China desk in those days, and I remember we watched as President Reagan slowly came around to the idea that a relationship with China, even fraught with some disagreements and so forth, was too important to ignore. But I remember thinking that President Reagan was having a little trouble adjusting his longtime hostility to the PRC with the fact that he was now dealing with them, because I remember we staffed his visit in 1984 to China, and it was a successful visit, and he had fun. But on the way back, he stopped in Alaska, and if my memory serves me right, he spoke of the Chinese as so-called communists, which was his way of getting around the idea that now he was dealing with them. Later on, Bill Clinton came into power, and as a candidate, spoke of the danger of butchers from Beijing to Baghdad, and he threatened various sanctions against China if it didn't improve its human rights record and so forth. But I think, in fact, one of the things he was trying to withhold was most favored nation clause for China, and he came around to the idea that the trade relationship was so important that even though we had our differences with China, you had to deal with them. George W. Bush was very strong about the relations with China as he came into power, and he spoke highly of Taiwan, which he had known through his family and so forth. But as I recall, first in managing the EP3 crisis that occurred early into his administration, and then after 9/11, recognizing that we really needed to use China as one of our partners in the global war against terrorism, he adjusted his policy to make room for strategic relations with Taiwan, with China, excuse me. Now, President Obama was lower key, but he and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton started out with a major focus on human rights and democracy, which I support in terms of the relationship with China. But as they got into the relationship, they realized that despite our differences with China, you couldn't ignore them, you had to work with them. So we get to the Trump administration, and the question of the day is what kind of policy President Trump will inaugurate, and how it'll affect Taiwan. So let's take a look at the pattern. I think, first of all, Taiwan has done a very good job of wooing prominent American political figures, both in Congress, in state capitals, and in the parties. I recall a conversation I had over 20 years ago in Beijing with Yang Jiechi, who was a young official in the foreign ministry at the time. He noted that President-elect Clinton had visited Taiwan, I think, 4 or 5 times. And he said, how does this work out? And I said, Taiwan has a very good record of casting a wide net and wooing political figures at the federal, state, and local level. And as a result, they had invited Governor of Arkansas, President-elect Bill Clinton, later on, to visit Taiwan several times. And I said to my friend, Mr. Young, I said, you know, if you just deal at the top of the American political system, you miss a whole lot, because the people who are going to populate the top are out there at lower levels, either in the federal government or in the state government or local government. Taiwan recognized that a long time ago. And Mr. Yang shook his head and thought about it, and I was struck by the fact that later, as DCM and then ambassador to Washington for the PRC, Yang Jiechi did a lot to improve outreach by the embassy, not only with the State Department and the White House, but with the Congress and other parts of Washington. So you can blame me for that, if you'd like. They also built, under Yang Jiechi's leadership, a very capable crew of Americanists in the MFA, people like Tsui Tian Kai, who is now the ambassador here in Washington. But the key question about China over this period was the amazing economic growth from 1978 on under Deng Xiaoping's Gaige Kaifeng opening and reform movement. And that introduced another element that had an impact on cross-strait relations and U.S.-Taiwan relations, and that was the very strong U.S. business presence and stake in trade with the mainland. Another thing that I think has been quite amazing has been the huge flow of PRC students to the United States. I remember when I was on the China desk in the 80s, we thought it might be 10 or 20,000. Then it went up to 50,000 and 100,000. And the numbers you hear about now are 200, 250,000. And I think that's great. In fact, you know, I think, and when I taught at Wesleyan, I had a chance to get to know some of the students from China. They bring home a much different perspective about the United States and about the world than they would have gotten if they'd studied in China. And now with so many of them going back to take jobs in the mainland where a graduate degree from an American university is a subject of prestige, I think they're going to become more and more important. So there's something to watch. I think another aspect of Taiwan over the years that has been quite impressive has been the amazing transformation toward a very open democracy. Zhang Jingguo began the process. I think Li Denghui was a key player, and I like to call him the father of Taiwan democracy, although there are others who could share that claim. Because though Taiwan did this for its own reasons, it has made it a lot easier for friends in America to respect and engage with Taiwan than it might have been if it was still the kind of authoritarian state that its neighbor across the strait is. Contrast that, of course, with the stubborn mainland resistance to any talk of opening up its political system. Even today, despite all of the other trends that have transformed China in the last 40 years, theorists like Sam Huntington and others have come up with a theory that as countries go through certain economic stages, they inevitably find the pressures from below and even from above to open up the political system to be greater and greater. Thus far, the PRC has bucked that trend. And I think today in 2017, it's still quite amazing that the Communist Party insists on a total control of politics in the PRC, despite a rising middle class and all of the differentiation of society that 35, 40 years of Gaige Kaifeng have brought to that part of the world. In fact, I think the only country in the region that makes China's political system look open is that of North Korea. And that's not very good company. I think everybody in this room would agree. So we get to this question of what policy toward Taiwan and the cross-strait relationship will be with President Donald Trump. Mr. Trump entered office, I think it's fair to say, with the weakest resume of public service experience in modern times. I mean, even Harry Truman had served in the Senate before he was thrust into the presidency by the death of Roosevelt. And Mr. Trump's policy team, foreign policy team, has been similarly inexperienced in, as evidenced by the fiasco of the selection of Mr. Flynn as the National Security Advisor. There are names out there that give me some hope. One of them is Randy Shriver, who is an old friend and who I understand may be in line for a position in the State Department. But we're still going to watch and see who he brings in, because I think both in the White House and in the State Department and other parts of government, President Trump needs some people to help him understand the nuances of a relationship that is so important to us. A lot of friends of Taiwan in this room were heartened by President Trump's phone conversation last fall with President Tsai, and I think it was a good thing. I think it was within the context of our informal relationship with Taiwan, and it allowed him to express his respects for the democracy that Taiwan has become. On the other hand, I wasn't surprised by the phone conversation last week with Chinese President Xi Jinping, where President Trump embraced the One China principle after having been somewhat ambivalent about that One China principle and the One China policy. They're both. It's a principle and a policy, which is a good thing. We don't want policies without principles, do we? So let's hope that President Trump is able to recruit other people with relevant experience to help in forming his Asian team within the White House and the State Department and other parts of the administration. Now, Taiwan has played its role extremely well. I'm a big fan of Tsai Ing-wen, who I met nearly 20 years ago. She's got a lot of very solid people that she's drawn into her tent, including David Lee, who used to be my neighbor in Taipei, Stanley Gao, who is the representative here, Michael Gao, and others who have a lot of experience dealing with us and can help her in crafting relevant policies for Taiwan. I'd like to take a moment to focus now on arms sales, because this is an important issue and one that has been controversial for a long time. I think Taiwan needs a new generation of fighter aircraft to match the mainland's developments which that paragon of democracy, I'm being sarcastic here, Vladimir Putin has done a lot to help by selling advanced aircraft and other military equipment to the Chinese. As somebody who's spent a lot of time looking at Sino-Soviet relations, Sino-Russian relations, it's good that China and Russia are trying to find common ground, but the geopolitics of that relationship in the long run suggests that there will be tension, there will be friction, there will be a rivalry. I also think we should help Taiwan in a low-key manner with its submarine program, something that has not been the case in the past, though this will not be easy because the United States stopped making diesel submarines a long time ago, so even the technology that Taiwan needs is hard to find. I think they've been getting some from the Germans who have some diesel submarines, but the United States went nuclear a long time ago. I also think we should look at upgrades to Taiwan's missile defense based upon not just the quality, but the number of missiles that it faces across the Taiwan Strait. There have been continuing close contacts between our two militaries, including sending active duty officers over to Taiwan, and I suggest that it should be a little bit less out of the ordinary to send general officers to Taiwan. I know that there have been occasions when that has taken the place, but the general standard has been to stop them at the colonel level. And of course, since my father was a colonel in the military, I know that that's very important, but there are times that senior officials can play a role. That said, we know that retired officials make a steady path to Taiwan all the time. I remember meeting Denny Blair as he just stepped down as the commander of the Pacific Fleet visiting Taiwan and being very well received by both civilian and military officials there. I want to put a little plug in for AIT, the American Institute in Taiwan, because it continues to play a very important role in managing our relationship. And in fact, I'm pleased that there will soon, they say this year, be the opening of a brand new 21st century office building for AIT in Naihu. And I hear some titters there because I found that site as deputy director of AIT in 1999. And if you told me then that 17 years later, 18 years later, it still wouldn't be finished, I would have shaken my head and said, that's impossible. But having been a part of the struggle with the bureaucrats in the State Department, particularly in the building office, to get this done, I recognize that it has been a long struggle. But my understanding is it is going to open this year in Naihu, and it will be a symbolic expression of the 21st century commitment of the United States to our friends in Taiwan. One accomplishment that I know my sister will be proud of, particularly because her son is in the Marine Corps, is that from the get-go, I made it a very strong push on our part in AIT that we would have a Marine security detachment protecting the mission in Taipei. And I'm proud to say that that is the case today and that we made sure when we were designing the new office building that we were going to build a very nice Marine house for our guys there, not only because they deserve it for their own purposes, but because wherever you go around the world, the Marine house is the social center of any diplomatic corps, and it will be in Taipei as well. To sum up, I think it's safe to say that the traditional U.S. commitment to Taiwan's security and well-being will continue under President Trump. As my remarks indicate, there is a deep and long-standing character to our ties with Taiwan. Those ties are bipartisan and grounded both at the federal level and through the many state and local connections between our people and the people of Taiwan. I understand we have some other speakers somewhere, and with that, I will look forward to listening to them and then getting into the discussion with all of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for that very high-level discussion on U.S. China relations and Taiwan relations as well. And I would just add one caveat to your comment about the readout for the talk between Trump and Xi Jinping is that the readout specifically noted that the Trump administration agreed to uphold the R One China policy,
that's right.
And so that's very clear and very important to identify that R as in the U.S. One China policy. And so now I'd like to invite our panelists to come join us on the stage so that we can engage in a discussion about U.S.-Taiwan relations. So please come on the stage. And now just as a administrative note, I ask that all the speakers please click. Make sure that the light is flashing red when we speak, and that way that the recording actually takes place. So in keeping with our past events, we prefer to have a discussion rather than lengthy presentations. So I prepared several questions to ask our panelists. First, let me introduce them. To Ambassador Young's immediate right, we have a very well-known author and East Asia expert, Gordon Chang. Gordon Chang is the author of The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown North Korea Takes on the World, both from Random House. His writings have appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Barron's Commentary, the Weekly Standard, I mean, you name it. Gordon has given numerous briefings in Washington and other capitals and has frequently appeared on CNN, Fox News Channel, Fox Business Network. I mean, it's really hard to turn on the news and not see Gordon on the news these days. He blogs for the World Affairs Journal and served two terms as a trustee of Cornell University. Now, to Gordon's right, we have my dear friend and colleague, David Ahn. David Ahn is currently a senior research fellow here at the Global Taiwan Institute. He was most recently a East Asia political affairs officer at the U.S. State Department from starting in 2009. He was the architect of the first Taiwan political military visits to the U.S., which have continued to occur annually. David received the State Department Superior Honor Award for initiating the series of visits and also for taking the lead on congressional notification of U.S. arms sales to Taiwan in 2010. Mr. An was a senior before joining GTI, a senior project manager for the THAAD missile systems at Lockheed Martin Space Systems Company. So we're very pleased we were able to poach him to come back from the very lovely weather of California to what we have here in Washington, D.C. And and David has been a Fulbright scholar and researched democracy in Taiwan and village elections in China. Now, last but not least, we have to his right, my friend Harry Kazianis. Harry is the Director of Defense Studies at the Center for National Interest and Executive Editor for its publishing arm, The National Interest, an excellent publication, and I encourage everyone to read it. He currently holds several fellowships focusing on national security and defense-related issues, including Senior Fellow Non-Resident at the Nottingham, UK-based China Policy Institute, as well as Fellow for National Security Policy at the Potomac Foundation. Harry is also a columnist for Asia Times. In the past, he has led the foreign policy and defense communications efforts at the Heritage Foundation, served as editor-in-chief of the Diplomat magazine, as well as a fellow at CSIS PACnet. He's the author of numerous books. He's a prolific commentator on the news. And again, like Gordon, Harry is very sought after in the media, and he told me also that he has 20 or so engagements actually, just this week alone. And so I feel for you. I'm very sympathetic, to your cause. We're really pleased to have this excellent group of panelists here to discuss the issue of U.S.-Taiwan relations. And so, what I want to like to start is, to really follow what Ambassador Young had also mentioned was there's a lot been said about the Trump Tsai phone call. And I want to sort of get a sense for what you think is the significance of the phone call and its effects. And maybe I'll ask Gordon for you to kick off this discussion.
Thanks, Russell. The most important thing was that Trump signaled to the Chinese that he wasn't afraid of them, that he was willing to break convention and do something that was considered to be inconceivable, something that hadn't occurred for a very long time. And that's important. When we look at China today, it is emboldened, it's aggressive, it's confident that it owns the 21st century. And because of that, it is violating norms. It is doing all sorts of things that are troubling not only its neighbors, but also the United States. And, in years past, I think, yes, American presidents have always said, well, we need China for this or that. But when we look at what China's been doing over the last half decade, this is a country that has been proliferating nuclear weapons and ballistic missile technology to the North Koreans. It's been cyber attacking the United States. It's been seizing shoals and islets in the South China and East China Seas. It's been sending its troops deep into Indian territory. The list goes on and on. And I think that what's important right now is for Trump, and he said this basically to the Chinese, I'm willing to do something that is going to irritate you. And I think it's important that we do those things because we have to defend freedom and democracy. And clearly, and when you look at freedom and democracy in the region, it's endangered, and it's endangered foremost in Taiwan.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for having me, Russell. It's a very distinguished panel. It's an honor to be here. The call for me, I think, is really boils down. I agree with you, Gordon, 100% on all your points. No mystery there. For me, the call really is, it comes down to one thing, hope. I think hope for a new relationship between the United States and Taiwan. But I think also in a lot of ways, hope for a new U.S.-China relationship. And Gordon, just as you basically laid out, really the Chinese for the last, I don't know how you want to slice it or dice it, maybe 7 to 10 years now, have sought to fundamentally change the status quo in the Asia Pacific. We can't deny that. No matter whether you're Democrat, Republican, left, right, realist, internationalist, whatever you want to call it, the facts are there in front of us. So I think what got a lot of us Taiwan experts or Asia hands just in general very excited is that this was a change. This was different. This was not an Obama pivot to Asia filled with talk and photo ops. This was action. This was real. You could almost touch it. You could feel it. So I think for that alone, that gave a signal to a lot of us that there was going to be a change in Asia policy. Now, I know there's been a lot of commentary about, that Trump has embraced so-called one China. And we can have a debate what that means, what that doesn't mean. It seems like everybody has their own interpretations, and I'm just going to leave that there. But I think it's safe to say that if you look at the people that Trump has brought around him, people like Peter Navarro, others, it's pretty clear that there is going to be a shift on China policy. The thing now that we have to sort of get past is what David Rothkopf today called in foreign policy the fog of Trump. Right now, we're in a policy environment in Washington where we're constantly moving through crisis after crisis after crisis. I think eventually what's going to happen, and I'm not a domestic politics expert, so I'm just going to throw my two cents in here, is that the Trump administration is going to learn the hard way that governing through crisis after crisis doesn't work. They'll pay a price for that. And then we'll slowly settle into a situation where policy decisions are made, where Trump will go out to Asia, or just recently we had Secretary Mattis go out to the Asia Pacific region and reassure allies. So I think over time we will start to see what this policy looks like for Taiwan and then for China and the region as a whole. But just to get back to the real question, I think when we talk about the call, it was hope more than anything else.
And thank you very much, Russell, and thank you, Ambassador Young, for the remarks. So there was a lot of debate within the media, a lot of people supporting it, a lot of people very, really against the Trump-Tai phone call. And a lot of key senior U.S. Former officials greatly supported it and went public about this. John Huntsman, earlier Ambassador Young mentioned Randy Shriver, Dan Blumenthal, they all went public saying this was a great idea for U.S., Taiwan, and the region in general. Now, the more puzzling part was the pushback from more of the liberal sources of the media, because are they pushing back against anything that Trump does? Or is it specific to the Trump-Taiwan situation? And I'd argue that it's really critiquing Trump, because the Trump-Tai call is in line with liberal values of liberty and freedom of speech and democratic societies and international cooperation. So really, this was aligned with that. So basically, I think it was a good move, and a lot of people would agree.
Harry, you brought this up, and I want to move to this question. And I know, Steve, we're sort of all just Ambassador Young, we're just all sort of referencing your wisdom here in terms of in responding. So feel free to jump in when you want. Harry, you brought up.
It's not J, it's M. I'm going to jump
in. Okay, got it. All right.
Like the former Ohio senator.
But Harry, since you brought this one up, I want to follow on this the U.S. one China policy comments. And so that's really to follow on. What do you think are the Trump's questioning? Again, of the one China of the one China policy, and then affirming that, and so maybe just presenting this to the entire panel to start off. Harry, you can start, and I know Gordon.
Sure.
Have some comments.
I think when we talk first about one China, in Trump questioning one China, let's. I think we all need to be honest here. I don't think our new president has studied in depth all of the nuances, the historical background, the caveats that other presidents have put on it, whether we talk about Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton. I mean, there's a history, and it's complex, and it's hard to understand. In sort of prepping for my presentation here today, I was literally trying to explain to my wife the one China policy. I confused myself. So let's be honest, it's complex. It is not an easy thing, and I think that's okay to say. So I think for Donald Trump to sort of question the one China policy, what he's really questioning, I think if we make it a lot more simpler, is the fact that the fundamental relationship between the United States and China. And I think that's a healthy thing to do. I think a lot of us in this room can make the argument very credibly that the U.S.-China relationship that we've had for the last 10 years, it doesn't work anymore. I mean, people are starting to question the trade aspect of that relationship. They're starting to question the strategic aspects of that relationship. And as time goes on, those things are favoring Beijing more and more and more. So I think a recalibration of that is a very healthy thing. When it comes to the Taiwan aspect of this, I think we have to wait and see. Like I said before, we need to move through these domestic political challenges before we get to the concrete nuts and bolts of policy. And I think we will do that. But I think when it comes to One China, I think, like I said, it was healthy to question it. And then the reaffirmation, if you will, to be honest with you, I didn't get that. I wasn't upset about that. I wasn't disappointed. As Russell had pointed out, what President Trump reaffirmed is our One China policy, which I think everybody knows in this room, that is a very different thing than what Beijing will have you believe what that is. So I'll leave that there.
I was a little bit upset by Donald Trump's phone call with Xi Jinping and the White House readout saying that I accept the One China policy. And the reason is that Trump, in effect, created a controversy with accepting the phone call from Tsai Ing-wen on December 2nd. And then you had the Fox News Sunday interview in December 11th. And then you had the Wall Street Journal interview in January. So there was this expectation that there was going to be a fundamental break in policy. I think part of it is, yes, he did backtrack, and I think that was a capitulation. And then the Chinese certainly see it, because you can read what state media says. You can see what Chinese academics talk about. They say that this was a contest of will, and we won. That's especially true because the New York Times reported that Xi Jinping refused to talk to Trump until Trump publicly acknowledged the One China policy. So it clearly was a confrontation, and Trump clearly backed down. The one good thing I take away from this, though, and this is something going back to what Harry was saying, was that, you have Michael Flynn, he's out. Before this phone call with Xi Jinping on Thursday, Michael Flynn and KT McFarland, his deputy, went over to the Chinese embassy to deliver that letter, and I thought that was a little humiliating. But fortunately, Flynn, who has been counseling all of this, is gone, and probably so will KT McFarland. And hopefully there'll be stronger, more resolute voices in the administration that will carry the day. Because as Harry says, and it's absolutely 100% true, our China policy, our Taiwan policies are not working for Taiwan, and they're certainly not working for the United States or the international community. And we need to change them, and we need to change them fast.
For those who are most sensitive about the One China policy, what's surprising is when U.S. decision makers, U.S. policymakers, and scholars essentially take on China's bargaining position as the U.S. bargaining position. Because China would want you to think it's their way, but there's another way, and the other way is to consider U.S. interests in the region with the shifting military balance and the activities that are going on there, and to consider who are the U.S.'s unconditional partners, like Taiwan, and allies like Japan and Korea. Unconditional, that's always been historically by the U.S.'s side. So here we see that there's the One China policy, it has this built-in ambiguity that allows positive relations between the U.S., China, and U.S., Taiwan throughout the region. So
that's great, and I think that's, and I think really what the sort of the next question I want to get at is the assessment of Beijing's reactions. And so I want to get your sort of assessment on what you think, Beijing's reactions since November has been to the phone call, to actions taken militarily. What do they signify? What do they mean in terms of how Beijing is preparing for this new environment that we're in now?
Well, I thought there was really two reactions in Beijing after the December 2 phone call. First of all, I think that essentially the military decided it was going to be more provocative. So we saw two of those flights around Taiwan, complete circumnavigation, and these large-scale exercises in peripheral waters. But on the other hand, I think the diplomats were at first dismayed. They were dazed. I didn't think they know what to do, because when you start to look at some of the things that they said, they were contradictory. They indicated a sort of a lack of resolution and purpose. So I think that it took them at least a month to figure out what to do. And now that they have, I think we're going to see a much more concerted approach on Beijing's part, both civilian and military working together. But that certainly wasn't the initial reaction.
We're seeing China have a very sophisticated, calculated set of carrots and sticks incentives and disincentives toward the U.S. and Taiwan. In China, it's authoritarian, it's very well coordinated. They're technocrats, they know very much what they're doing. And the incentives and disincentives, for instance, to lay out what we mentioned earlier about a precondition of a Trump-Xi call, hinging on the One China policy. And on Taiwan, a whole range of activity China toward Taiwan, only speaking to the KMT and not so much to DPP, cutting back on from the high-level political to the mundane, cutting back on Chinese tourists to Taiwan. So really just using this toolkit that they have to punish what they don't like.
Just quickly, it was interesting sort of to watch the very short historical narrative when we had, President-elect Trump make the call with Tsai Ing-wen and watch the Chinese reaction. Just as Gordon, as others have said, at the beginning, you have to admit, Beijing really didn't know what to do at first. And then there's a slow progression, I think, over the weeks and months where Beijing basically tried to say, I'm summarizing here, he doesn't really know what he's doing. He doesn't know foreign policy. He's an amateur. Let's wait and see what happens when he becomes president. And I think that was sort of their coping mechanism, so to speak. But I can tell you, I'm pretty sure, I think we all know Donald Trump is a consumer of the news. As we watch his tweets and other things, he's reacting to media at a very different level than other presidents have in the past. And I'm pretty sure that he was reading some of these reports, and I'm sure he's keeping them in the back of his mind. So now it's just a question of where the policies are going to go from here. And I think really that's what we have to watch.
Watched in all these sort of actions that we've seen Beijing take is that there was a transit stop that President Tsai Ing-wen made during her return from Central America. And, some have characterized these transit visits as low-key, as that, she was, trying to not to upset or make too high profile of a visit. I mean, what do you think that the transit visits signified and symbolized in terms of how the new administration in Taiwan, the Tsai administration, is approaching this new sort of new balance and the relationships?
Well, the transits show that Tsai has a lot of friends here in the United States. She went last month to San Francisco and then also to Houston. San Francisco makes sense because she's trying to turn Taiwan into Asia's Silicon Valley as a key part of her economic policy. And Houston makes sense because there's great barbecue there. So last year, mid-year, she stopped by Miami, and Congresswoman Ross Lightman went to visit her there, and she also stopped by L.A. What's concerning, though, is that there are no stops Washington, D.C., and I think about 1971. I think about Taiwan stepping away from the United Nations / getting voted out, and I wonder if things would be different today if each side played their cards differently back then.
Transit stops and what it means. In terms of how the Tsai administration is approaching U.S. relations and China relations?
I think there's a long history of managing transit stops, and I didn't see things much differently this time than they'd been in the past. We do seek to allow a respectful process for transitors, and whether it was Ma Ying-jeou or Chen Shui-bian before her, there were times when we pulled them back from things we thought were more provocative, but it's always been an opportunity for them to see friends in the United States and to champion their cause, and I think that Madam Tsai did that rather effectively in this latest transit.
Well, I would also add that, all this is happening against a backdrop of increasing international pressure exerted by Beijing on Taiwan's diplomatic as well as international space. I mean, we saw that with Gambia even well before she was inaugurated as president of Taiwan, and followed by Sao Tome and Principe, and the downgrading of the representative office in Nigeria. And I guess, really sort of moving into the discussion into sort of what's next, what can the U.S., sort of policy do to try to, counter or help enhance Taiwan, well, counter these, sort of Beijing's tactics, and also how to enhance Taiwan's international space. What can you comment on that, and also in what terms of what U.S. policies could be?
For a long time, I've counseled my friends in Taiwan that their real friends are the United States, Japan, Singapore, Australia. The battle over these countries, many of which probably most of us couldn't find on the map, is a legacy of the past. And of course, the dignity of Taiwan is a fragile thing in that respect. But to me, the very robust relations that Taiwan enjoys with the key partners, and Japan is right up there, as well as Singapore, those are more important. And if you go and visit Taiwan and look at the missions of those countries, they're very robust with expertise and connections to the top of their government that serve in all but title to be very robust diplomatic relations. And you know, I've told some of my friends in Taiwan over the years, yeah, I've courted these guys, but don't spend too much money on them, because that's all it is. It's money politics to me. And again, many of these countries are perfectly willing to pull up stakes and switch if the price is right.
Yeah, my sense is the same as Ambassador Young's. But one thing I would do if I were Donald Trump would be to say to Taiwan that America's relations with Taiwan are going to be whatever you want them to be. You know, it's not for us to say what the, you know, how you define your statehood and all the rest of it. But if they want robust relations with us, we should give it to them. If they don't want them, that's fine too. That's their choice. But it seems to me that we should have a Taiwan policy that is divorced from our China policy. And we should stop thinking and worrying about what Beijing will say if we do something. So, for instance, if Taiwan wants to be a state, then we should recognize them as such, and we should protect them. You know, our sense is right now we've got a China which is attacking American values across the board, and certainly undermining our interests and the interests of the international community. So we have zero interest in maintaining cooperative relations with China, especially because they're not helping us. So whatever I would drive this relationship by responding to whatever Taiwan wanted. I know that's probably not going to be a view that everyone will accept, but nonetheless, we're in a existential fight with China, and we need to defend ourselves, and we need to defend freedom and our allies and friends.
Gordon, let me just jump in. I'll be brief, David. Just to jump off from Gordon's excellent points, I think the foundation of all of this comes to the cross-strait military balance. And let's face it, really since the late 1990s, that balance has shifted dramatically in Beijing's favor. And look, let's face it, that makes sense. The Chinese economy has grown dramatically. They have much more resources to bear. They have a much larger population. So that was naturally going to happen. But what I think the United States can do here is to ensure that Taiwan has a deterrent where if Beijing was ever to start thinking about any type of military action or even to go so far as thinking about outright invasion, they would have a moment of very